Welcome to Free Thoughts from Libertarianism.org and the Cato Institute. I'm Aaron Powell.
And I'm Trevor Burrus.
Joining us today is John Popoli. He's the director of Freedom on Trial, the new movie from Libertarianism.org. He's the founder, CEO, and executive creative director of Emergent Order, an Austin-based creative agency and film production company. Welcome to Free Thoughts, John.
Thanks for having me, guys. It's a real honor.
So I want to get into these new movies from Libertarianism.org, Freedom on Trial, but I mean, let's start by giving our audience a bit of your background. How'd you get into filmmaking?
So if I step back before really getting into being interested in video, I've always had a sort of argumentative bent. So I always I've been getting into political debates with friends and family for probably longer than I had an interest explicitly in filmmaking and video and editing and the craft of film and video. But when, in a way, when I think about it, some of my earliest video projects had a political bent. My co-founder, Josh Myers, and I, who's also been my best friend since fifth grade, actually made a political satire in high school that for the little internal like closed circuit TV system in our little Catholic high school. So, you know, you could say we sort of got started at this intersection of trying to do, you know, creative video and also have a kind of, you know, political or philosophical bent. I went to film school coming out of high school, and coming out of film school, that interest in philosophy and politics really took a back seat. And I got a job entry level at MTV, actually in the animation department, the folks that did Beavis and Butthead and Daria and Celebrity Deathmatch. And then over the course of 12 years, worked up through the MTV networks of, you know, the collection of networks that are owned by Viacom. So I worked at MTV. I worked at Nickelodeon, which is also where I met my wife, Lisa, who's the other co-founder of Emergent Order with me and Josh. And then moved to Spike TV. And at Spike, I ended up I was there for 7 years, and the last several of them as one of two creative directors. And so as a creative director at Spike, I was responsible. I would direct some spots, some commercial spots and some longer form sort of marketing interstitials and pieces like that. But then I also oversaw the overall communications and marketing for about half of the network's content, their launches, the show launches. I was responsible for the campaigns for a show called Deadliest Warrior and A Thousand Ways to Die, both and a lot of other sort of stuff at Spike, as well as like the big award shows. So that was I started off in film school and ended up professionally working at this intersection of, you could say, film and commerce in the form of advertising and marketing.
What sort of stuff in those years, MTV and Nickelodeon and Spike, what sort of stuff, the most interesting things that you worked on at that time, for example, at MTV, did anything that listeners might be familiar with?
So I think when I was at MTV, I graduated in 99, started working in MTV, began working in the series development department for animation. And when the dot-com boom hit, that entire department was eliminated in one of the largest layoffs in like MTV Network's past 20 years. And I actually lost my job and then was, after several months, found a new position at Nickelodeon. So I was a victim of the credit cycle, even though I wasn't yet super engaged in the boom and bust the way I would be later, from a philosophical, you know, causal standpoint. At Nickelodeon, I worked on, in the promos department. So perhaps my most famous project was I was given my first chance to edit a movie trailer. And it was for an animated TV movie special for a show called Rocket Power. And the movie, So it's like this, it's the show for, you know, there might be members of your audience who watched it growing up, but especially if they're millennials, but the show, was this group of kids who were, lived in Hawaii and were like sort of skate kids without too much of a hard edge to them. And the movie was essentially terrible because it's just, but the approach I decided to take was if I'm going to cut a movie trailer, I want to do one of those big, awesome movie trailers with the guy that says, "In a world." And so I watched every movie trailer I could find on the Apple trailer site, which is still a great place to find them. But at the time it was probably one of the only places to like aggregate movie trailers. And then basically ripped off all of the best tropes I could. And then I wrote this script, tracking against that, treating the movie like the most epic thing you will ever see, and then actually got the famous Don LaFontaine, who is the guy that made famous the "In a World Where One Man Must Fight." One team must be put to the challenge.
That sounds incredible. That's exactly what I'm going to watch when we're done recording here.
And so, and you know, in a way, it was like my first professional success in that I had wrote the script and then I edited the piece myself on my laptop, which at the time was right at this transition point as the industry was starting to transition from these big expensive edit rooms running on the Avid system to off-the-shelf Macs running Final Cut Pro. And so that combination of being a creative but also being a tech geek was something that was a big part of my career progress, like you could say. And to cap the story off, I guess, is that I remember talking to my mother, who was down at the Jersey Shore at the time, and she said, "You know, I went over Aunt Rita's house, and there was a sticky note on her television to watch the Rocket Power movie on February 14th. So that trailer, and at the time, that really fairly poor TV movie, I think got some of the highest like one-time ratings Nickelodeon achieved. And there wasn't a lot of, and I think in a way, like that is that approach of taking a kind of genre style and applying it in a new domain is something that's come to dominate a lot of what we've done at Emergent Order, including Freedom on Trial. Mm-hmm. You see the sort of echo of, hey, here's this fun topic. How can we take like a big entertainment convention and overlay it in a surprising way? And it's something that just, you know, the Kane's Hayek rap videos do that. The Cronies did it. And I think Freedom on Trial is like the latest incarnation of this effort to sort of blend unlikely ideas with style forms.
So if that's how you got into filmmaking, how did you get into libertarian filmmaking?
the vast marketplace of libertarian filmmakers,
yes.
Of course. How could you avoid? How could you not bump into it along the way? So I've told this story a couple times that when the Hayek versus Keynes rap videos that I created with Russ Roberts came out. But the short version is it was this intersection of the rise of social media causing political debates, especially in the run up to the 2008 election, to become way more heated and way more present, even in a workplace that has nothing to do with politics. So the 2008 election, you know, Facebook starts to escape from just being something college kids use in 2006. And by 2007, you know, everyone in your office is suddenly on Facebook and starting to share their thoughts about the election without any sort of social norms sort of established. Not that many have been established since, as I think about it, but just sort of unfiltered. And so the political sort of dialogue was accelerating and being very pulled to the foreground at the same time that I was now older, married, had a mortgage, was concerned about interest rates, and the financial crisis and the sort of breakdown of the mortgage market and everything was something that up until that point in my life, I don't think I had the skin in the game to care about. And so that was sort of a broader context. And then in particular, Ron Paul's sort of singular voice pointing to what seemed like the only rational, plausible take on what was going on really was the invitation for me to take a look. I'd always sort of seen myself as a conservative Republican, essentially inherited from my family, as a lot of people's politics are. And it was really through Ron Paul, as well as essentially being, you know, spending over a decade working in the diversity of views of New York City, that in a sense moved me to the left into libertarianism, to the point where I very much feel more like a left libertarian in a lot of respects. You know, my concerns, that what animates my interest in libertarianism is a very humanistic belief in freedom as an empowering force for good, as opposed to a kind of religious adherence to the Constitution or a kind of traditionalist, well, this is the American way. Like, I really believe that freedom and the sort of classical liberal conception of it is the true path to like human betterment. And so for me, that's what all gelled as I think I got more mature and circumstances, you know, raised awareness about, well, what's happening in the world of politics and economics.
Talk a little bit about the Hayek-Keynes rap battle videos. What was the genesis of that? Was that your idea originally and you contacted Russ, or did you come up with it together? How did that end up happening?
It's a very odd idea.
Yeah, if I just pitched it to someone immediately, especially at the time, because rap battles are more common. I guess we have the epic rap battles of history and of course, Keynes Hayek. And so I feel like at the time, what year did the first one come out?
We released the first one, Fear the Boom and Bust, in January of 2010.
Right. I remember hearing, so that was, I had been at Cato for 6 months or something, I think, then. And I remember hearing there's this Hayek-Keynes rap battle video and you got to watch it. And preparing for it to be really bad because it sounds like the kind of thing that would be really bad. And then it totally wasn't.
So Econ Talk. So as I said before we started, this podcast has actually entered the top of my list alongside of Econ Talk. But my first love will always be Econ Talk.
That's OK. It's ours, too. So it's fine.
And so I had this long bus commute, which was essentially my schooling, because I didn't take any formal economics in my education. And so I was listening to Econ Talk as well as like Planet Money from NPR, which was always exceptional and very classical liberal, really, when you listen to it, you know, because they are interested in actual facts. After the election and with the bailouts and this massive stimulus program, I was really animated into a kind of activism. I wanted to try to get the message out that we're doing all the wrong things, that we're like repeating the same mistakes that got us into the mess, in my view, from reading about Hayek and listening to Ron Paul and reading Monetary Mischief from Milton Friedman and listening to Econ Talk. And so I decided, actually with a lot of instigation from my wife, Lisa, who really said, you got to do something interesting with this interest because, man, this economics that you're so excited about is the most boring thing in the world. and she's always pushed me to try to think in a mainstream way because I can be about as hardcore a libertarian geek as one can find. And if you don't believe me, pick up the Laissez-Faire Books edition of, you know, A Tiger by the Tail, because I wrote a foreword for it, which is like my faux attempt at being an intellectual. I reached out. I cold called Russ Roberts because I thought, well, hey, if I just try to do something about the boom and bust on my own, who the hell is going to pay attention to me? I'm not an economist. I don't have any credibility in that domain. And I also want to check to make sure I'm even like getting some of this stuff right. And so I cold called Russ, left this like winding message about how I was a creative director at Spike and got interested in monetary policy and wanted to make a video with him. And I was really excited about Hayek. And when Russ called me back, I swear this was more exciting than any celebrity shoot I'd ever been on or directed. And I even got to shoot a shot for shot recreation of the original Back to the Future movie trailer with Michael J. Fox. And yet even including that, I think I was more excited to get a call back from Russ Roberts.
We were pretty excited when he came on Free Thoughts too, so we understand.
It's weird how I'm hearing the voice come out of someone.
I know. he's just – I really believe he is the best living economist today. And I say that because I think he has he embodies that classical liberal political economy that's richer than most economists who've come up through this much more mathematically oriented, much more equilibrium minded school. I mean, he's a true economist. So we started to have a dialogue, and Russ is a very small C conservative person when it comes to taking on projects. He's always very busy. A lot of people I learned approach him about things. And so it took about 9 months from the first phone call to the completion of Fear the Boom and Bust. And we took many zigs and zags along the way. It didn't start off as a rap battle. We originally thought, well, maybe we'll do like a faux sitcom with Keynes and Hayek as like the odd couple. And then we thought, well, that's going to be really hard to pull off and it might not be very good. So why don't we do the show open and make like a funny, spoofy show open to that show. And that'll be the video. And then Russ made an offhanded joke about doing a rap battle, and I immediately glommed onto it and thought, you know what, that's actually a great format for a back and forth and the cadence of rap. And I wasn't much of a rap fan, which is the other ironic thing. So I had to basically – have either of you seen the movie Hustle and Flow?
No. Have you seen that movie?
No.
So in Hustle and Flow, it's the story of a pimp who has rap talent and becomes like an up and coming rapper. But you watch it very tangibly happen. Like he just lays down these rhymes and he's got a buddy that's a music teacher and he takes his rhymes to his buddy and he's like, well, you don't have a hook. He's like, well, what's a hook? It's like, it's the refrain. It's what repeats and sort of pulls you in. And I literally had that exact same experience. I did a one crazy overnight pass on the first lyrics of Fear the Boom and Bust that probably got them about 75% to 80% there, and actually did a recording of it. I brought it into to Spike, and I used the instrumental version of this song, Remember the Name, which had this simple strings kind of classical rhythm as a bass, and played it for a buddy of mine that was also a musician. And he listened to it. He's like, that's actually pretty – that's not bad. But there's no hook. There's no refrain. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's right, the refrain. Well, how many of those do you need? He's like, oh, like about every 12 to 16 bars. I was like, oh, well, what's a bar? It's like, oh, each – yeah, I mean I was really like – it was like a child recreating something that's been well understood for centuries. It's like, oh, well, like every line is like a bar. And so like 4 bars is a measure. And so, okay. So then I went back to the script and said, well, the first 4 lines are a pretty good refrain. We've been going back and forth for a century. I want to steer markets. I want them set free. There's a boom and bust cycle and good reason to fear it. Blame low interest rates. No, it's the animal spirits. And so I took that, copied it basically every 4 to 6 measures of lyric, and then worked with it with Russ for like 3-4 months. And then and Lisa found the actors that play Billy and Adam, who play Keynes and Hayek. And because Russ is such a great public intellectual and such a welcoming personality, he had great relationships with PBS and NPR. And so that gave us some initial coverage to help us launch the project. So we actually had the folks at PBS NewsHour film at one of our recording sessions. And there was before the release of the video, there was actually a story on NPR about the rise of Keynes. And I have to say, like, it was pretty neat because that story became not just the rise of Keynes, but the debate about Keynes versus Hayek, which it wouldn't have been had they not engaged Russ and I about this project. So like, in a way, we had already started to make an impact on getting Hayek's ideas out to more people even before the video was released. And that taught me a lot about the way you can kind of work with media, you know, friends in the media to kind of help you know, make an impact and balance out the story that's out there. No, and so, you know, it was released on like the end of January in 2010. And it was just so salient because, you know, we were right in the thick of this debate about stimulus and what grows the economy and how do you get out of what caused the Great Recession and, you know, why is the unemployment still, you know, so high and all of that stuff. So really, it was a very fertile time to sort of bring this kind of approach to the table. And it got him. And we didn't have any media dollars behind it. Frankly, I don't think you could reproduce. It'd be very hard to if we launched the same video today, I don't think it would have gotten the kind of traction without a different amount of like support than what happened back in 2010. And then we had we did a sequel in 2011, Fight of the Century.
So the sequel was just sort of by popular demand, or I mean, I know there was a lot more attention, of course, paid after the first one, and then people just sort of wanted more. It seemed like I did. I know I did. So
after the first one, it was really when I first started to genuinely become aware of the broader movement outside of, frankly, the Cato Institute and Econ Talk. Because I was listening, you know, Cato has always been a go-to for me as far as finding a great source of ideas and just raw material to try to understand what it means to be a classical liberal and what it means to, have a free market operate and solve problems in a free market society. So I started to get approached by folks in the movement that were interested in trying to do more things like this. And it seemed like people weren't expecting it. I don't think people thought it was possible to do something like that. So Russ and I were invited by The Economist magazine to their annual Buttonwood gathering, which is this kind of highfalutin conference with like heads of state and central bankers and all kinds of crazy people. And so we wrote, and this was in the fall of 2010. And so at that point, the video had gotten over a million views all organically and been covered all over the rest of the media. And we decided, since that was such a big opportunity, we wrote lyrics as a kind of sequel follow-on and had Billy and Adam perform these lyrics, and they were an early version of Fight of the Century. And that video is actually on the Econ Stories YouTube channel, the Buttonwood Gathering event. And so coming out of that, and it was very, I mean, it was like, you know, central bank, the head of the Central Bank of England at the time was there and all kinds of crazy people. So we then had this raw material and Brian Hooks and the folks at the Mercatus Center had helped raise money to make another bigger, better version on the basis of that script. And so I wanted to just take everything to the next level. So we brought in this awesome vocalist, Charlie Murphy, who happens to be like Eddie Murphy's brother, but he's got this great voice and presence. And we made the song more of an exchange. So instead of in the first one, it's just Keynes says his thing and then Hayek says his. And the second one, it's much more of a battle where they're like, you know, parrying and sparring back and forth lyrically. And we took the production value way up and had a much bigger crew with tons of extras and this period set and this boxing ring and then it really kind of matched the trajectory as far as the media interest, because, you know, tragically, 1 year later, the debate about the boom and bust was just as present in people's concerns as it was, you know, a year prior because of the depth of the Great Recession. And that, and it's just a sort of button on that, that project, Fight of the Century, was the sort of maiden voyage for me as an entrepreneur. Josh and I left Spike, and the three of us with him and Lisa started Emerge in Order, and that was our first production as an independent company.
So let's turn to Freedom on Trial, which came out. We are recording this on Wednesday, and it came out on Monday of this week. And so we approached you, we being libertarianism.org, approached you guys to do a cool video stuff for us, because we were terribly jealous of the other people who got to do cool video stuff with you. Well, first, tell our listeners, if they haven't watched already, which shame on them, but we'll put links in the show notes, what Freedom on Trial is and then how this idea came about.
So when you guys approached us, we were very excited because obviously Cato really is the, you know, the premier libertarian think tank and sort of institution. And so it was a really exciting opportunity for our team and for me personally. And, you know, and also what was just so great is that your libertarianism.org, you know, is very much an, a safe space to engage ideas without without necessarily being tethered directly to the more tangible mechanics of particular public policy. So it's a chance to engage the audience with the fundamental ethical and economic and moral frameworks of classical liberalism and a free society, both historically and today. And so that was a we don't always get to be doing projects that are so fundamentally educational and idea driven, but that's what we exist to do. That's why I started this company with my friends and family. And so Freedom on Trial is very much in keeping with that tradition of the Keynes Hayek rap videos and of the Cronies, which was another project that we had done several years back, of taking a popular media form, in this case, a kind of serial courtroom, like a procedural courtroom drama a la, you know, Law and Order, and using that as a device dramatically to engage freedom-related subjects. So in this case, you know, the setup of the story is that we have Lawyers for Liberty, an underdog law partnership of William and Holly, who try to take on underdog cases of people whose rights and freedoms have been, you know, constrained or trampled or under threat, and defend them in the court of law and the court of public opinion.
Sounds like the Institute for Justice.
Yeah, it's the dramatic telling of the Institute for Justice or the Pacific Legal Foundation, and so in this what we really saw again, like aspirationally as a pilot, was that they would take on this case of Philip Carville, a small hardware store owner who has a young employee that he's paying below the minimum wage and is prosecuted for doing so, and the case takes a dramatic turn when its frame and its scope is broadened by the prosecution to really be a discussion of inequality in the country as a whole. And so obviously that's a very salient topic right now, but it's also very evergreen. And you know, it's always convenient how they never want to index the minimum wage to inflation, because that would prevent politicians from getting to reignite it as a new issue every several years. Mm-hmm. So that's obvious. But so that's the basic story. Is it's a legal drama, with high personal stakes for the characters, and along the way we get to hear the flavor of the arguments that on both sides, and again in keeping with, I think, the ethics of you guys and your organization and of libertarianism.org. And it was such a great collaboration because you really encouraged us to be, to give both sides strong arguments and to let the debate that takes place be a full and balanced and robust debate. So even though our sort of heroes, if you will, are the classical liberal lawyers, we didn't hobble the arguments of the prosecution or the other side in any way. And that was something that was a kind of ethos that began with the Keynes Hayek rap videos for me personally. And I just think it's a great way to engage dialogue.
How does that then impact what you're hoping viewers of Freedom on Trial will get out of it? Because if it had been – so the one way to present it, which is how we opted not to, which would be to have the libertarian side win. You know, we say here's a bad set of bad arguments and we're going to knock them down and therefore liberty. And that would be a clear goal. Our goal would be to show the audience that the arguments in favor of the minimum wage don't work. And well, I think we did a bit of that. This, like you said, trying to give every side a chance to express their view as strongly as possible and take them seriously. it ends up leaving things. I mean, we won't give away the ending, but it ends up leaving things a bit more ambiguous. And so, what were you hoping that an audience, someone who watches that, who's not already, say, a committed libertarian, gets out of it? If it's not that libertarianism trounces statism,
I think that one of the things I learned about politics, broadly defined, political economy, debates over big ideas, from being at in Viacom and being someone who was politically not sort of in the mainstay of my peers on a lot of issues, was that you get more bees with honey and you engage in much more rich dialogue with people when you don't immediately push their buttons and trigger their tribal impulses. Nobody wants to listen to you if they just think you're a jerk or if you're being too strident in your position and don't seem to even know or care about their concerns. And so, you know, I think with all of our projects, we try to do this. We try to, and it's not just a matter of like sort of strategic positioning, although I think it does that too. But to disarm people of their prejudices in the body of the project, to have the, I think, like, you know, for us, like having it be very highly produced is part of that signaling of making something inviting to watch. But then I think having you can't avoid the fact that these are deeply contentious subjects and that there are well-intentioned people on both sides. And I think if you just set up the opposition, in this case, people who believe that government not only should have the right to interfere with the agreements of two consenting adult parties, but that it will make them better off or it will make society as a whole better off. You know, nobody's twirling their mustache as a villain thinking that, for the most part. I mean, maybe a handful of narrow interests are doing so, the sort of like the bootleggers of the crowd. But most people want to make the world a better place. And so I think you have to, I think it's important to embed that understanding in your storytelling. And I think as a filmmaker and as a storyteller, you have richer, more dramatic characters when they're not just white hats and black hats. I think white hats and black hats is boring. I think the character complexity is a huge part of what makes a dramatic story be dramatic and be surprising. And if you know what the ending's going to be right before you start, are you even going to watch to the end? Like I think it's both philosophically and morally a good way to go, and I think it's dramatically a good way to go.
Was this a different kind of project than Emergent Order had done in the past? Was this something new to you guys and how you had to go about doing it?
Well, we had done one scripted dramatic web series prior to this that I think was sort of a good prototype in a way, which was the LoveGov series that we created for the Independent Institute. And so we had already managed, I think, to successfully tell a character-driven story that had a didactic framework to it without it being, one commenter said, this is not cringeworthy, which in one hand feels like faint praise. But I think when you're trying to actually like unpack these kind of ideas, that's actually great praise from my perspective. Because it's like you said, you know, the pitch of these things, your first impulse is, oh, that's not going to be very good.
Right.
Yeah. And it's kind of interesting. That's like, that's the real fascinating, I guess, challenge that you're engaged with. And it's what we thought about when we were discussing the different concepts for the movies was what would not be cringeworthy. And it's kind of odd because there's a lot of tropes out there. Like Captain Planet.
Which is being turned into a live action movie.
Well, I think Leonardo DiCaprio wants to turn it into a live action movie.
Oh, I didn't know that. Yes. Oh, no.
Captain Planet is I mean, absolutely unbelievably ridiculous. But people don't really perceive it as I mean, I think people perceive it as ridiculous because it's a 90s cartoon and it's a little bit pompous, but not because the evil corporations are trying to kill the environment and there's a superhero saving it. And if we tried to make a, I don't know, Captain Capitalism or Captain Free Markets or something like that, I mean, I guess we could do it if we parodied Captain Planet. You should put that one in your idea bank of Captain Free Markets that parodies Captain Planet. But it would be very cringer. Or if we tried to make a movie where the government, because businessmen are often the real big snidely whiplashes who are always twirling their mustaches, and it doesn't make people cringe. But it seems that we have a cringe deficit in terms of trying to convey libertarian ideas without sounding too preachy and not having people just cringe at what we're saying.
Yeah, and just to piggyback on that, I mean, you notice this in not just in the more didactic filmmaking that, you know, we're engaged in as the Cato Institute and libertarianism.org, who have a message we want to promote, but also in just general, say, Hollywood filmmaking. It seems like the left is able to get away with producing more ideological stuff than libertarians or conservatives are. That when, you know, you can watch a Hollywood movie that has an extremely leftist message and simply enjoy it as a movie, but when it's a libertarian or conservative message, that cringeworthiness often comes out and is often, you know, it's a justified response on your part. Like the film simply is more cringeworthy. And so why is that? Why does the left seem better at making non-cringeworthy political stuff than we are?
It's a great question. It's something I've thought about a lot. I think that, well, first, and I, you know, just before things get away, if we don't come back to it, you know, our team had put together, as you know, like 5 or 6 different unique ideas that were all intended to be something that you could repeat to tackle many different subjects from a classical liberal point of view. And it was actually Max Borders, who's one of members of my team, and you know, really like a great, you know, philosopher and thinker in his own right, that came up with the idea for Freedom on Trial. And then we discussed, well, should it be Freedom on Trial or should it be Government on Trial? So there's a lot of the process of just arriving at the idea, you know, as you got to experience with us, is this big, broad exploration. And then the second half, which is really like the 98% that matters in another sense, is that, well, okay, we've got the 2% inspiration. How does the perspiration, how does the execution play out? Which is, I think, something that we've always tried our best as a company to do. And I think that's the first part, is I think that there's a craftsmanship deficit creatively on the, God, I hate to say on the right, but I guess I'll just say it, like on the right. I don't know why that is. I don't know if it's like genetic, that there tends to, you know, if you tend to be more creative and aesthetic, that your brain tends to be wired to be a little more collectivist. There's something there. There's a clear ideological delineation between creative fields versus more systematic fields like engineering and construction and other disciplines, and as far as the way people's politics break down. But I think one other like big picture is, I think people in the political circles, especially that, you know, on the sort of free market or right of center, so to speak, have this notion that Hollywood is sort of driven by ideology. And I actually don't think that's correct. I think there's an ideological bias that's like endogenous, like I was just saying. But Hollywood just wants to make money. Hollywood's like Randian capitalism on steroids. It's very transactional. If you don't have to look any further than the post Passion of the Christ bout of Christian TV shows and movies that were suddenly all the rage. It's, you know, if it can find an audience, the business folks in Hollywood are going to make it. And so that leaves us with this question of, if it's not sort of a systematic bias at the business level, it's an aesthetic bias. And I actually think we have a real challenge on our hands, because what is our story? Our story is the invisible hand Our story is trying to show the unseen. These are not easy things to point a camera at. You know, I mean, one of the things about if Mises's Human Action is a canonical tome of classical liberalism, it has a corollary in the storytelling world, which is Robert McKee's Story. And in that book, I mean, it basically is the human action of storytelling. It says people's character is revealed through action. It's revealed through the choices they make. Not what they say, it's what they do. And the problem we face is that dramatically, a lot of our stories are often not of the individual motivations and intentions of a person, but the actual like outcomes of systematic incentives that actually, like as Milton Friedman would say, guide even bad people to do good things. Well, when you're trying to tell a character story, people's individual motivations matter. Like you judge the character. The goal is to have their personal character revealed. Like it's like why the word character both means a person, but also their nature, their moral frame, like their moral nature. And I think that's really hard when you're trying to say, look, yes, this statement that we want to help poor people that are working live better. Well, I can do that by passing this law that tells these greedy rich people to pay them more. That is that the intentions are there. And so you can tell that story, that Mr. Smith goes to Washington story of the reformer that takes on Capitol Hill to, you know, the classic, like probably the best example would be the movie Dave. Where you've got
I was
this,
just
like,
going to say, Dave, yes, this. Is, yeah. I love that movie, but it is also just absolutely aggravating. But yeah, you wonder how you could tell that if it was a libertarian story.
Well, I made the crack, I think, Trevor, a while back that the reason I adore the West Wing TV show, which is not a popular opinion, I think, among my colleagues.
I do too.
But I had remarked to Trevor that a libertarian West Wing wouldn't work dramatically. It would be boring as hell because it would just be a president sitting in the Oval Office saying, well, I ain't gonna do anything about that.
Yeah. There's nothing. That's beyond the scope of what I am capable of doing. I don't have the knowledge or incentives to do it.
Yeah.
It's like, okay.
It would not make for an exciting 45 minutes of television.
Yeah. And in Dave, he the big thing is what he proposes employing, having the government give everyone a job. And it's just absolutely infuriating. But then you're like, hey, it's kind of, you know, endearing in its own way.
Yeah, and I think that's it's baked into character-driven storytelling that we care about the character's motivation. We care about a real live person and what they do. And so we have to somehow find a way to tell freedom stories that are about individual people's character. I mean, that was what we tried to accomplish with Freedom on Trial by, you know, presenting the impact of these two people and framing it around that, and it's still it's very, very difficult. I think there are some great movies that point towards ways of doing this. I think one of the best is Dallas Buyers Club.
Agreed. That was my next question, actually, which is, what is your favorite libertarian movie? But
oh, my favorite libertarian movie is real easy. It's Ghostbusters by a million miles. It is the most libertarian movie ever made. I don't know if it's just that like markets were when the air in the 80s. I mean, I'm actually looking across my office right now at a framed LP of Ghostbusters and the complete like $500 worth of Legos set of the Firehouse and the Ecto-1.
Wow, he's really not kidding. I'm impressed you're willing to admit that on the air. No, that is interesting. I've heard the Ghostbusters thing a lot, and I agree with you. And it's interesting because I often say Dr. Strangelove is one of the great libertarian movies, but that the both of those movies are incidentally about freedom and markets and entrepreneurship, or in the case of Dr. Strangelove, the complete and utter idiocy of people in the government, which I think is important. It can be difficult to to go out and intentionally try to make an ideologically charged movie. But if you incidentally tell a story of freedom, then it might be a little bit more resonant. And that's also true of Dallas Buyers Club.
I think it's this, you know, there's these sort of dramatic structures of man versus man, man versus the nature, man versus the system. And I think that there's a lot of great freedom storytelling to be told in the framework of man versus the system, which is what Dallas Buyers Club is. And to some extent, it's what Ghostbusters is. The bad guys are – it's like it's hard to tell who's the bigger bad guy, the EPA regulator or the actual ghosts trying to destroy New York City. You know, and he's like the classic Adam Smith man of system, you know, Walter Peck.
Yes. Yeah, it is true. That man has no dick. Isn't that the question? the famous line in the movie. You know, it is a great libertarian classic. But again, that's the interesting thing about the challenge of Freedom on Trial is it's obviously explicitly ideological to some degree, but you also have to tell a story that's worth watching.
With compelling characters.
Yeah, and I think it's like you have to find ways of grounding. Of staying at the ground level, at the level of human action, of people doing things. And you have to let, I think, good storytelling – and look, as a firm and as a storyteller, we don't always get this right. I mean, you know, but we try to actually put story first on the basis that if you don't have a good story, nobody's going to walk through the door. So no matter how nicely you've set up the room, if they don't walk through the door, it doesn't matter. So the story has – and I think that's – you know, so I think there's this class of didactic movies that are garbage and they do span the spectrum. There's probably – because of the sheer volume differences, there's probably as many horrible left-wing ideological screed movies as there are free market or right-wing ones. The free market ones stand out to the extent they're free market, in fact, at all. Because of the success to failure ratio on the right is way different. but I mean, you like take a movie like Elysium and you could argue about whether it's really an analogy about immigration versus an analogy about economics and capitalism. But I mean, that movie is horrible. And it wears its ideology on its sleeve in a way that the prior film by that director, District 9, didn't do.
So where do we take Freedom on Trial from here? Do you have ideas for things you'd like to explore in future episodes?
Well, I think if the world of support for the project, you know, comes to the table and is interested in there being more stories like this, I think what we tried to do with the series and in thinking of it as a pilot is set up a structure that's repeatable in that they can take on so many different kinds of stories. I mean, like you guys mentioned, you know, the legal advocacy groups like IJ or PLF and almost any story out of their docket is something that I think could make for a compelling case. I think it'd be interesting to take on the victims of the drug war and to really take on things that are less obviously on the political right, like, you know, things that surround criminal justice or immigration, for that matter. I mean, to take on this some of the more populist issues that are soul crushing as a libertarian in 2016. But I think there's a kind of endless supply of human stories where the lawyers for liberty could make the case for more individual freedom and autonomy.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed today's show, please take a moment to rate us on iTunes. Free Thoughts is produced by Evan Banks and Mark McDaniel. To learn more, find us on the web at www.libertarianism.org.